his wing.
I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Current Geek. And this is the Film Festival episode of Current Geek for the month. A special monthly look at the greatest movies of all time from a geeky, nerdy perspective. Our monthly look at the best film ever continues, or films ever continues, this time with It's a Wonderful Life. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. Hi, Tom.
Well, Scott.
Mary. Tom.
How about the moon? I'll lasso it for you. I really want to go and memorize the actual things he says, because the quote is always, I'll lasso the moon for you, Mary, which is not what he actually says. And I love figuring out those little things, like, though this be madness, there is method in it, is the actual line from Shakespeare, not there's method to his
the madness. So, exactly.
What about the moon, Mary? I just put a lasso up around it. I can't remember exactly what he said.
Yeah, so go, but that's what we do. We hear it. It's iconic. Then we shorten it, and then it's in our head forever. And then we Mandela effect it, and it ends up being like Vader saying, I am your Luke. I am your father, which he didn't say. He said some other way of saying it.
No, but, Luke.
Or he said, I don't even think he said Luke. I think he just said, no,
I am your father.
Yeah. So there's no Luke in there at all, or there's other Star Wars ones. Anyway, we all do it. This movie is full of those. I was surprised by that. It's a Wonderful Life, everybody. It really is. But also, that's the movie we watched. And we decided that it would be a good idea. Now, this thing is old as dirt.
It's old and yet always around.
Yeah.
NBC has made a tradition since the 70s now, I think, at least the early 80s, of showing this every year during the holidays. Well, I almost want to say you can't escape it. You can. You just don't watch it. But
sure.
but like it's a big thing for NBC. Like, this is our airing of It's a Wonderful Life, and they usually air it again on Christmas. So it's wonderfully accessible. It was briefly public domain for a short while until Paramount realized that they could execute the copyright on the derivative rights of the book.
So what
happened was they didn't renew the copyright back before the 1976 Copyright Act, and it went into the public domain when the 1976 Copyright Act came along. And so you don't need to renew copyrights anymore. They just stay around forever. Anything that was in public domain stayed in the public domain. So the film It's a Wonderful Life is technically in the public domain. However, Paramount, which ended up after a long series of it getting passed around with the rights to It's a Wonderful Life, also had the rights to the book that it's based on. And the book that it's based on, I'm going to pull it up here in a second, is The Greatest Gift by Philip Van Doren Stern. Novella, I guess. But with Paramount owning the rights to that, that means they also have the right to make derivative works of that book. And since It's a Wonderful Life is in the credits based on the story, The Greatest Gift by Philip Van Doren Stern, Paramount can stop anyone from distributing It's a Wonderful Life without their permission, since they hold the rights on the book.
Interesting. I had no idea it was even a book. Like, this is way more info than I even knew.
Well, and the book, I mean, I say book, Philip Van Doren Stern wrote this back in the 30s, shopped it around, or maybe it was in the early 40s, couldn't get it picked up by a publisher. Yeah. So he ended up mailing 200 copies of it to his family and friends in December 1943. And one of those family or friends somehow got it in the hands of somebody at RKO Pictures, who looked at it and were like, make a great movie. And the rest is history.
Yeah, it's he calls it here in the history a pamphlet. So it wasn't huge or anything, but he sent it out.
It was a novella, I think, would be even.
Sure, probably kind. Closer. Short story, whatever. Yeah. But 1943 was the year he did that as a Christmas card. And somehow it made it to Frank Capra, who shared it with Jimmy Stewart. And then those guys worked on talking to that dude and got him to agree. And then, boom, you got your movie. Now, here's the thing. 1947 is the year that you get this here film. And like you said, it's everywhere. And every year it shows up, and it's. You know, for people my age, and your age, it was Christmas Story was kind of that thing for us. This weird movie that came out that now just shows up every year, and we end up seeing it usually or whatever. Everybody's kind of got their Christmas movie, but this is like the king of all of those. This one lasts, it stays around, and it's always around every year. And I've seen it, I don't know how many times, but a bunch of times.
Seriously, yeah.
Right? Here's the
bit. I think you and I might be in the same boat, because we've both seen it a lot of times, but when was the last time you'd watched it before this time?
Probably 8 or 9 years, I think.
Same for me, maybe longer.
Yeah.
It may have been the 90s since I'd seen it.
Maybe longer for me as well. So it's been a while. And to be honest, I just kind of think of it as a trope and a stereotype that it exists even at all. And you don't really, I quit thinking about it in story terms or its longer form or any of that. I just think of it as this one note. Christmas, life is good and you should remember that and don't throw it away because you never know. You know, that, I just,
Merry Christmas, your building and loan. Oh, thank you, Mary.
Exactly. All of those.
By the way, we apologize in advance for all the horrible Jimmy Stewart impressions we will continue to do on this episode.
Oh yeah. Guaranteed, dude. There's no way around it. But, that's all I remembered really. And so I haven't given it a ton of thought. And when it came up on our list, there was some discussion and I remember thinking, oh yeah, that probably is on this list for a reason. I mean, it's, you know, it's more than just maudlin sort of, you know, teary eyed entertainment. There's probably something more here. So yeah, I'm down to watch it. Here's what happened though. Oh, and we should state right up top, Tom watched the black and white version as it was originally made. I watched the colorized version, which came later, and they're both on Amazon Prime. That's where we got these. I don't know when it was colorized. I couldn't tell you. But we decided to do that for to sort of contrast and compare and see what we thought of, you know, the different presentations. And already there's heat on Twitter about people talking about how you just don't even want to go near that colorized version. Blah, blah, blah. And I know that's a
Paul
general...
Paul and Storm was giving you a hard time.
Specifically
about that, yeah.
Paul and Storm. I got 2 emails about it today. So people are, you know, they have their opinions. And generally speaking, I'm kind of with people on that. Like, I think the colorization process is freaking weird. Especially the Turner one, very early on, everything looked real orange and strange, and I wasn't a big fan of it. I have to admit, I think the colorized version of this movie looks pretty good.
I was going to thank you for taking one for the team, but you liked it.
I kind of did, and again, I'm usually one that hates this. I don't think you need to mess with it.
Yeah.
And I'm not even saying it needs to exist. Like, there's no overriding sense that, oh, if this wasn't color, it wouldn't be nearly as good. No, of course not, but it's actually pretty vibrant and looks pretty good. And it surprised me that it was as bearable as it was. And to say bearable is not fair. It was fine. I got into the movie in such a way that I quit thinking about whether it was color or black and white. It didn't matter. Probably in the same way that somebody watching it in black and white doesn't think about it or it doesn't matter. So it really got out of the way early. And I think the texture and the tone of the film still holds up through that process and is not a problem. So if you're really opposed to black and white and it just makes you tired or whatever your reasons are against, you know, pre-colorization era of film, then I think this is fine. I think it's okay.
Now, the thing to note, if you're out there saying, I've seen the colorized version and it's crap, two things. People have different opinions about stuff. And right. Second, there are 3 colorized versions of this. I believe the one that is available on Prime Video is the Legend Films colorization that was done for a DVD release in 2007.
Okay.
And that is the only one approved by Capra's estate. Capra originally was in favor of colorization, but then when he saw what happened with the first one, he was like, yeah, I don't like that. And he withdrew his approval. Mm. That was the one released by Hal Roach Studios in 1986. There was also one done by Republic Pictures in 1989. And Capra and Stewart were both very critical of those first 2 versions.
Right.
But the third one by Legend Films that was done in 2007, after the technology has made quite a bit of progress as well by 2007, not approved by Capra himself, of course, because he was gone by then. But Capra's estate said, okay, yeah, we'd like this.
Yeah, that artificial, the ability for colorization to sometimes create artificial light where there was none or change contrast or whatever, that didn't seem very apparent to me in this. It felt, after a while, I'd had to remind myself, oh yeah, this wasn't filmed in color. Like, it's actually pretty convincing. And I think the tones look good, especially the flesh tones. And when it's dark and he's running around in the snow and we're kind of in the middle, you know, toward the end of the movie and things are a little bit weird, they retain that sense of contrast of black and white, snow and dark, without losing color entirely. So there's just something about this particular process that felt fine to me. So anyway, for whatever it's worth, I thought it was fine.
Yeah. Again, I can't, maybe I should give a little more detail on this. Capra wanted it colorized.
Right.
He was excited about having it colorized. He was going to put up half the money to have it colorized when he was working with a company called Colorization Inc. However, as soon as Paramount realized that they owned the copyright on it, Colorization Inc. no longer could colorize it because it wasn't public domain anymore.
Right.
And another company, which was Hal Roach Studios, got the contract from Paramount to colorize it and shut Capra out. So it wasn't, he wasn't objecting to it on the grounds of, I don't want it colorized. He was objecting to it on the grounds that he wasn't allowed to participate.
Sure. Now, that all that aside, essentially same movie, same cut of the movie. There's no, you know, extra scenes or anything weird like that.
Yeah.
It's just colored or black and white. So Tom and I effectively saw the same movie, just from a slightly different cones and rods sort of perspective. Here's the bit that I had completely forgotten about, and that is almost the entire early goings. I don't remember when he was a kid, even though there's this crucial thing with his brother and saving him.
Oh yeah.
There's a real plot hole there later, but we'll get to that in a minute. I don't remember most of his growing up stuff, leaving high school, getting ready for college, which, by the way, none of them convincingly played recently graduated seniors from high school. I just want to put that out there. Just absolutely.
I don't know. I thought they had a good youthful attitude.
Sure.
They certainly didn't look like high schoolers.
I guess that's the thing.
But people looked older back then. I'm not even joking. If you go look at some old high school yearbooks from that era, those people look like they're in their 30s. Like,
yeah. And that's how this looked. Everybody looks like they're in their 30s. Looks like they've already got a good smoking habit going. Like there was all that. But I don't remember any of that. I don't remember the swimming pool bit where it opened up and they almost fell in at that party.
I'd forgotten about the swimming pool bit too. I'd forgotten about him going to college. I forgot that was a whole plot point, was that, you know, he basically sacrifices all his dreams.
Right.
To run the building and loan.
And I feel bad about this because I actually think the film is kind of genius at the buildup, and that's the big surprise in this viewing, was how much I enjoyed and how much I admire the structure of that movie from the beginning until we get to like where the first run on the bank happens, because that's kind of where I remember it forward. That's more my memory of where the movie kind of starts and ends. And so all that stuff before, I just never appreciated, or I walked out of the room, or I wasn't paying attention, or I don't know what.
No, I definitely remember when I was a kid being bored, like, okay, when do we get to the angel? Like,
right.
After the first time I'd seen it, right? I was like, wait, where's the good stuff? I want to see him when he's dead anywhere, or not dead, but he'd never been bored. You know, get me there.
Yeah.
This time watching it, I'm with you. Like, I was just savoring all of this. Like, wow, what great story buildup. What great depth of character. This is why you love George Bailey. And why everything makes sense is such care and good pacing, I really think, despite what I just said about being an impatient kid, at keeping you interested. If you don't know what the story's about, you think it's just going to be about George Bailey, you know, giving up his dreams and what happens with him. And it's a straight ahead drama at the very beginning.
Yeah. And it has, it's the kind of drama for something made in 1947. I think this is really key and important. It just has a lot of clarity to it. It's not a lot of muddled audio, which is typical of stuff from that era. It sounds really good. I don't know how remastered these versions are. They might be super remastered for all I know, and they've done all kinds of
things. I know the black and white one that I watched had been restored.
Okay. So I have to think at least the master audio tracks sound amazing. There's never moments of like too much weird noise in the foreground or background like you get with a lot of movies from this time. Even movies we've seen on here before kind of have a noisy quality to them that isn't intended. It's just kind of, you know, on set stuff. They don't have isolating microphones like we have today and things like that. It sounds really good. It looks really good. The sets are very convincing across the board. Like, I never felt like I was in some fake Wonderland. And I agree with you. I think it was the impatient kid in me who just couldn't wait. I just wanted to get to the magic part. And that's all that I cared about at the time. But this stuff is so important for that to be the payoff that it is. The net effect was how I realized how short, actually, from the from Angel forward, from almost jumping off the bridge till the end, is really short. It's like the latter quarter of the film is all.
Yeah. I mean, we don't get a whole lot of time with Clarence.
No.
Odd Body.
No.
He's only in the last third of the film. And yet that's what everybody remembers because it's such the powerful twist.
Right.
Right. The Sixth Sense is a little bit the same way. It's a long time before you get to the point where you're like, oh, that's what's going on.
Okay. Yeah. Until he drops that ring. And I'm guessing if you're a younger viewer, the same thing. Your memory might be skewed for about when the sort of the climaxes start to happen and you start to, your brain starts to remember this stuff. But I'm so glad, I haven't felt this way about a lot of movies that we've done or in movies in general lately. I am so glad I saw this again. And I went in thinking I was going to go, oh yeah, I can see why it's awesome. It's sure, you know, it's old, so there's some problems and blah, 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 whatever. But instead, I really enjoyed it and I got misty-eyed and kind of choked up at the end. And that's not supposed to work now, is it?
No, no, not from 1946. I mean, it was released in 1947. It was made in 1946. My gosh, yeah. I was impressed by how well the dialogue still works. Yeah. Like, this is real dialogue. Again, another thing, even in some of the best movies from that era, there's a little bit of a set play to how dialogue works. Mm. And it's movie dialogue, right?
Right.
That doesn't happen here. You've got people interrupting each other and bumping into them. What I remember that bit with him and Mary,
yeah,
when he's walking her home and talking about lassoing the moon, being way smoother. I was so happy when I watched how stuttery it is and how real it is and how there's real, not dirty, but, you know, racy innuendo,
mm-hmm,
that's totally explainable to your children, but at the same time, the kind of stuff that people would actually say when they're high schoolers kind of flirting around with each other, you know, and the whole thing when she loses her robe in the bush, like,
yeah,
that's some racy stuff for a G movie.
Oh yeah.
But it's handled so well by Frank Capra, and all the situations feel so natural in 2018 still.
Yeah, weird.
Like, okay, they wouldn't be dressed like that. You know, they maybe not have the exact same concerns, but it still felt like real people interacting.
Yeah, everybody across the board. And I also just loved, I loved feeling like I wasn't being jerked around. Like, I know people think this stuff's super sentimental, and it is, but usually sentimental things make me feel like I'm being manipulated.
Yes.
I didn't feel that way.
No.
In this viewing anyway, and I haven't previous to this either, but I never really thought about it, but I didn't feel like I was getting yanked around at all. In fact, I just feel like I was going with the motions. I think James Stewart is really incredible in this and just acts his butt off. And I think there are tones of like the kind of 40s era overacting on film, like the kissing and the scenes where there's a lot of Vaseline on lenses and that stuff happens. But those are just tricks of the trade at the times, like zooms in the 70s or, you know, screen wipes in the 80s or whatever. You have those things and I can live with those. Those aren't a problem, but the development of those characters, their arc over time, her resistance to him and his overtures when he'd start talking about serious relationship and then she'd start singing and turning the other way again was really authentic to me. It felt really real and important for whatever reason. And by the end of that thing, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is like a genuine rad movie, not just a thing of its time. It's a thing of its time too, because there's some stuff in there like I don't know what a building and loan is. What the hell is that even?
That's a savings and loan.
Okay, that's what they call it. What they call them now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a building. Building and loan was specifically set up to help people buy houses.
Right.
All right. We'll build you. We'll build your house. And loan you the money to buy it from us.
Right. And I never heard of that previous to even this viewing. I was like, I never even thought about it.
But it's an old fashioned thing.
Sure. Know? And all of that stuff just felt real. The kids all felt real in the beginning. I mean, they're all kind of whippersnappers in the sort of, hey, mister, you got a dime kind of way, but that's fine. I've never ridden on a shovel in the snow. That's not a thing I've done, but still that I'm sure that was a thing kids probably got into or whatever.
Well, that's another thing that I like. There's no reason that, I know that Kepper actually funded a lot of this himself. He got it away from RKO.
Mm.
But I don't think he would have, you know, he could have bought sleds. I'm sure they had sleds on the lot and the thing was shot, I don't know, a few miles that way from me.
Yeah.
We looked at a house that's on the ranch where they shot this back before it was bulldozed and turned into a housing development. But they could afford sleds, but I like that he's like, no, what kids did in the teens when they were kids in this movie, it was a period piece, right?
Sure.
It's like what kids did back then is they just grabbed a shovel. They couldn't afford sleds back then. Yeah. Sleds were expensive.
Yeah. What was that? It was supposed to be 1909 or something.
Yeah. Something like that.
Something like that. And I don't know what 1909 looked like. I mean, there was still sort of the old West happening and who knows what was happening on the East Coast.
Well, and there's a lot of controversy over where this actually is. Mm-hmm. Capra indicated it was somewhere in New Jersey, although there's a place in New York that claims that it's the real Bedford Falls because it kind of looks like Bedford Falls and it's in the same region, but it's definitely in that, you know, New England area.
Interesting. I didn't realize there was, well, I guess I never thought about where it was from. I just figured, oh, hey, look, it's Middle America town. Could be anywhere, kind of Springfield like quality to it. And you can, any state could probably claim that they got a town just like it or whatever. But another very effective part of the movie that I, again, don't remember the nuance of when I was watching it when I was younger was the transition of what the town, what Bedford Falls is before and what it is after the angel removes his existence. And it turns into this kind of seedy New York kind of street with a, you know, with a bit of an obsession with burlesque and whatever. It's very effective, like very effective at making me go, oh, I don't like this. I don't like when it happens to a town. I don't like it. It's too much growth, too fast. Urbanization, bah. Like I have these, all these emotions that are just as, I think, relevant today when you see, you know, something that's relatively pristine or has some value in that way to you, a place you grew up or whatever, and you see it change or get bulldozed over or change. It sucks kind of. And us having those feelings, you know, and I don't know. It's just weird. I didn't expect any of that. I thought it was just going to be, it's like the final third of Christmas Carol, right? The whole story is basically that. It's Christmas. It's the ghost of Christmas future, in this case, an angel who comes and shows you what the future is going to be like. But the twist is you were never here. And so that's the one twist on it. But really, it's that same kind of idea. And then he has a big change at the end. Scrooge wants to go get the biggest goose out of the window and now celebrate Christmas because now he loves everybody and wants to save Timmy. In this one, George just wants to run around to everybody, including Potter, and tell him Merry Christmas and accept his arrest if he has to. He's just happy to be back and happy to have his family.
Okay, but I think that hits on one of the brilliances of this. This is not a happy story until the end, right? Yeah, it's got a classic Frank Capra happy ending.
Sure.
Because the whole town comes together. But this is a guy who keeps giving up his dreams for other people.
Right.
He wants to go to college. He wants to travel the world. He wants to see Europe. Nope, nope, nope. Got to stay at home. He gets beaten down because his alcoholic uncle loses $800. That's a real problem. That's not a sugar-coated problem, right?
Yeah.
This isn't, you know, like some honest mistake. This is, Uncle Billy is proved to be incompetent throughout this film. You love him anyway, mm-hmm. but the only reason he's in there at the building alone is because he is George Bailey's uncle. That's it. And he screws up to the point where George is going to have to go to prison. So what does George do? He goes to the bar and gets drunk and wrecks his car. Like these are modern problems. These are things that there's drunk driving. There's being mean to your family. That scene where he's snapping at the kids and telling them to cut the racket. That's an uncomfortable scene. That is not a nice George Bailey.
No.
That is an angry George Bailey. And it's not a, well, he's kind of miffed because of the problems. Like, this isn't a Hallmark movie, right? Like, he's bad. Yeah. He's a bad George Bailey. And he wrecks his car and is about to commit suicide, right? Like, this is a dark, dark movie, but it has to become the beautiful light movie that it becomes at the end when he's shown, like, hey, man, for all your problems, it'd be worse without you. Let me show you why. And then it becomes a fantasy. Then it becomes a sci-fi fantasy where alternate reality steps in and an angel shows him the hellscape that would happen if there was no George Bailey in this world.
I agree. He gets really violent even. Like it's a violent, he has a violent turn, not necessarily against anyone, but there's, you know, a lot of grabbing people like his uncle and shaking him really hard and holding him up close and getting all pissed and then breaking everything in his path, going home and kicking over everything. And kids are watching this, like that kind of father rage is scary. And he really nails it. And again, not something I remember till now. Like I didn't really pay attention to that stuff, I guess. And it's very affecting. And when he tries to apologize and they're all just too scared to accept his apology. And it's really rough. Like it's a rough point. It really sells the point that he is at his last leg. And it really, the only part all of that made me do though, in a 1947 versus a 2018 sort of way is go, was there no FDIC back then? Were these organizations not backed by the federal government?
In fact, The savings and loan scandal of the 90s happened because savings and loans were not protected by the FDIC in the same way. Yeah. So yeah, the building and loan is not got an out.
No.
Right. And even if it does, if they're suspecting him of embezzling $800,
yeah,
which is a lot back then,
yeah,
then he's still going to jail. Doesn't matter if the deposits of the people are insured.
Right.
You know, he's done for. And the other thing is, yes, this is back in the world of bank runs, right?
Yeah.
So the FDIC came about as a result of the Depression, as a result of the 30s. I assume by the time George Bailey, you know, is making his uncle is making his mistake, that the FDIC is in place, but not for a building and loan. It'd be for Potter's Bank. Potter's Bank would be covered by FDIC.
Yeah, that's true. He's got the notoriety to do it. Boy, that guy's a real jerk anyway.
Well, no, because he's a bank, not actually a
bank. Yeah, that's true. And he funds everything and he's an a-hole. But anyway, the some of those things that pop into my head, like if you were missing $8,000, and I know $8,000 was a lot of money in 47.
Sorry, I keep saying 800. It was 8,000.
Yeah.
I keep thinking it's 1909 instead of 47. $800 was a lot of money back then.
It's a lot of money. It's probably something like, I don't know, it's probably $250,000 an hour. I don't know what it is, but all that stuff rang, you know, real in terms of the impact or the stress it would put on him and everything. But it did feel like that entire industry and business was a little too simply connected to very tenuous agreements, if you know what I mean. Like, and I know a lot of life is that, you know, it's not all part of this is my own naivete about certain things like this, but it just seems like that is a very precarious business to be in. And any minute, everybody could show up and try to get their money out
Yes. And honestly, Scott, that's what we saw back in 2008 a little bit, because even though we have FDIC now, FDIC only covers $100,000 of your deposit. Now, for most of us, $100,000 is plenty.
Sure.
Right.
That's a good chunk of money.
Yeah. If suddenly all the people with more than $100,000 show up, FDIC don't cover it.
Right.
And that is, I don't think that's necessarily out of time. I mean, the bank run that happens was a historical thing.
Right.
Like the bank runs are what caused federal deposit insurance.
Right.
Because it's one of those things where, and honestly, It's a Wonderful Life has an excellent economic lesson, which is a bank doesn't have your money.
Mm.
Your money's not here, Fred.
Right.
It's in her house and his house. And, yeah. Right. Like that, they use that to explain to people like, this is how banks work. Banks don't keep the money. They take your money, hold it on deposit, but loan it out so that when people pay it back, they pay it back with more. They give you a little bit of interest. The bank keeps the rest. Everybody's wins. I mean, that's the ideal,
that's
right?
The
that's
idea.
The way it's supposed to happen.
Sure.
And so the building loan was just operating on that premise. And what's interesting, Scott, is the bank run that you're talking about, when he has to convince people not to take out the money, that's a historical thing that happened to the banking institution in the United States. It's a real thing.
Right.
What screws him in the end with the $8,000 has nothing to do with that. That's about the bank examiner being here going, where is this $8,000?
Right.
You have promised to have it in your bank vault and I don't see it. Mm. I am the bank examiner that is here enforcing the regulations put in place after the bank runs of the 1930s to make sure we don't have bank failures. And look what you're doing.
Yeah.
You're embezzling $8,000. So that could absolutely happen in a small bank in a small town somewhere today. If a bank examiner came in and they didn't have the money they were supposed to have, if they said we should have this much money in the vault and it wasn't there, they'd be like, well, who has it then?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, it was interesting to.
Oh, and Sidian says FDIC covers $250,000.
Oh, $250,000. So. Okay.
We're gonna get everything wrong, people. Okay.
Yeah, it's just the way it is. Yeah. Get used to this getting wrong.
We are poetically correct.
One of the most successful careers in the movie came from the kid who played Little George. His name is Robert J. Anderson, and I did a little deep dive on this kid. So he plays George when he's, I don't know, supposed to be 10 or 11. He's got a job at the local drugstore. There's a whole little subplot there going on. And, boy, that guy's violent, too, smacking him around like that. It's a different time in 47, I guess. But anyway, he's working at this place, and this is after he saved his brother from drowning and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, well, where's that kid now? What's going on with that kid? Because a lot of people in this movie, as I often point out, Tom, are dead. They're not here anymore. It's a big empty scene set.
So you were hoping, you're like, maybe he's the one.
I thought he might be the one. Now, there are some of the kids are still alive.
Zuzu.
Yeah. Yeah, Zuzu's still around.
Zuzu's still around.
And the whole, the angel gets his wings. That her? That's not her, is it? No, that's...
I thought that was Zuzu.
Is that Zuzu? That might be her name. I forget whose name is which kid, but...
Zuzu is the one who asks him to fix the flower, and he takes the petals off the flower and sticks them in his coat. And then later, when he's no longer been born, the petals are gone.
Right.
And he knows he's been restored to the proper timeline because Zuzu's petals are in his coat. And he goes, Zuzu's petals, thereby naming the future rock band Zuzu's
petals. Nice. Also, Bert and Ernie, although I'll talk about that in a second.
Not.
Because it's not confirmed. Not confirmed.
Since you brought it up, Capra, or actually Sesame Street spokespeople have said, total coincidence.
Oh, have they said coincidence?
Because I said okay. It was not. That was not the inspiration for the name. I still think that it's possible that subconsciously, that was in their head, in Henson's head. Yeah. But you got to remember, It's a Wonderful Life. We haven't touched on this. Was a failure at the box office. Mm-hmm. Considered a failure at the box office. It lost. What did it lose? $525,000.
Jeez.
In its initial run, it was not a moneymaker.
Yeah.
They released it in December in limited release, mostly in New York, thereby putting it in the Oscar competition with a bunch of really good movies. So it didn't even get the award buzz. So it was kind of a forgotten movie for a while.
I love when movies do that, when they take on a new life later and everyone loves it and they can't get enough of it. And it like changes film forever.
It doesn't feel like that happens as much anymore.
Well, when it does... I think we're still too far away from seeing the impact sometimes, like for modern stuff. But a semi-modern example might be, we were talking about one the other day, right, on FilmSack, and it was an exact example of this, and it was a movie in the 90s that just took on crazy amounts of popularity outside of the theater. Another good example of this, it's not quite the same, but Buffy the Vampire Slayer as a film was not a big hit. It was kind of a mediocre, floppish sort of deal. But the idea lived on, became a very successful TV show, and blah, blah, blah. Like there's examples like that. But anyway, my point about this kid. So Richard J. Anderson, I thought, well, he probably, cause most of these kids, you look up the kid credits, this movie, maybe a couple others, they don't go on to be big time actors. This kid went on to make a whole bunch of movies. And at the same time, while he's a kid, even before this movie, and then all the way up until his final credit of 1993 as a production manager, he spends the entire time in the industry as a big name production manager. He was the executive in charge of all production of Demolition Man, Passenger 57, Bonfire of the Vanities, Blue Bayou, No Holds Barred. I mean, a real mix of weirdness. TV shows like Ripley's Believe It or Not, Wonder Woman. If you get into the 70s, you got like Columbo, Police Story, The Time Tunnel, and so on. And when he was... his first credit. Yeah, his first credit was something called The World of Henry Orient as unit manager. And he just had this very cool, successful thing. But he died, too. He died in 2008 at 75. But that also tells you how old this movie is. He was 75 when he died. It was crazy.
By the way, Bagheera 74 pointed out something that I did not know, or I didn't notice, but it makes perfect sense now. You were mentioning the pool, scene with the gym floor opening. The kid who opens the pool, cause he's mad at George Bailey for stealing Mary away, is the same guy who played Alfalfa.
What?
In Little Rascals.
No. For real?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
Carl
crazy.
Switzer, who in IMDb is listed as Carl Alfalfa Switzer.
Let's see. Oh, there he is. He played Freddy Othello.
Yeah.
Oh, that's weird. Oh, now I see it. Now I can see his face.
You totally can, right?
Oh, yeah. It took a second for me to like combine the two, but yeah, I can totally see it now. Oh, that's really funny. He was a lot older in this. I guess he was born in 27. Oh, he died early, 31? Jeez Louise, that's a sad story. I forgot about that. That's a thing.
So back to the movie not doing well and then coming back and becoming bigger than ever. It was probably the mid-70s when it really took off on TV.
Yeah.
Like that's when it started to be shown every year. I think, let me see.
It's a good example though. You're talking about a 25, 30 year window or more than that before it.
So 30 years later, let's go with that for now.
Okay.
What's a 30 year old movie? So a movie from 1988 that's now suddenly becoming big. Or we can even go 86, 87, whatever, somewhere around there.
I feel like Breakfast Club was an okay hit, but not huge and didn't do expectations, but became this thing that every generation loves. Maybe that's it. Breakfast Club, maybe. Maybe. Kind of. No.
Maybe. I'm not discounting it.
Let's see.
I feel like Breakfast Club was always kind of a cult hit right from the beginning, but it's not bad. It's not bad. Cause it is definitely one of those things like that people that you like, really, you kids like that?
Breakfast Club? I got another one here. Well, we even talked about Citizen Kane once, but this list I'm looking at claims Citizen Kane. But the one I was thinking of is confirmed here, or at least this list agrees with me. 1982's Thing, The Thing. I remember John Carpenter's The Thing not being a runaway hit and kind of a disappointment, and everybody was super sad about it. And then The Thing became huge later. And when VHS came around, it was like gigantic. And I remember as a young person running around a movie like a Blockbuster and looking at a wall of The Thing, and it was an old movie by then, but people were just like, couldn't get enough of The Thing. This list says Rocky Horror Picture Show, Office Space, Wet Hot American Summer, which I still don't think I agree is any good, but whatever. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, this list says, and it gives a bunch of reasons why. So it's certainly, you know, examples out there. Yeah. This might be the biggest one though, because this is like, generations of people have come and gone who all look at this movie and think this is the greatest thing ever. But I would argue that if you are one of those people who says Die Hard is a Christmas movie and people tell you no, it isn't, but then you say, okay, well, this it's no different than this movie, I'm with them. In other words, this is no more or less a Christmas movie than Die Hard was. They both culminate right around Christmas. That's their only connection to Christmas. It's not a Christmas movie.
Although.
Or is, and depending on your point of view.
I've been on both sides of this argument with It's a Wonderful Life.
All right.
They have Christmas trees and snowmen in the opening credits.
Yeah. Yes.
So I'm not saying you're wrong, but it very, very much the intention here was to make this a Christmas story because of the fact that at the end, when everything goes well, it's also Christmas. And it's the Christmas spirit. And I feel like that's one of the reasons it didn't do well, because it went into wide release in January. And you go and sit down in January and you see a film start with Christmas trees and snowmen. You're like, wait, wasn't that last month?
Yeah, it's a little bit weird thing to have happen. But the reason I would also, this is an argument of favor of seeing these two movies actually as Christmas movies, because I do, but a lot of people don't, at least in the Die Hard thing. If that rule about Christmas trees and snowmen in the opening credits of this movie are a way of saying, yes, it's a Christmas movie, then I would point to the opening credits, which is also includes some action and dialogue, but the opening credits are running during Die Hard, where they play Christmas and Hollis from Run DMC while he's in the limo getting to the building. So I'm just saying Christmas, and it ends with like Sinatra or somebody, I forget who, singing a Christmas, like a legit Christmas song, and there's stuff all through the movie. I'm telling you, Die Hard's a Christmas movie, damn it, is what I'm saying.
There are two kinds of people in this world, Scott. People who realize Die Hard is a Christmas movie and people who don't care.
All right. Well, I don't want to be the people who don't care. I love it.
I mean, it really is one of those things where like very few people really want to argue about it, right?
Yeah.
It's like Die Hard's a Christmas movie. Okay.
Yeah. It's actually my favorite yearly Christmas argument, because most of them are fraught with religious stuff or political stuff. And I like this one because it's so non-consequential. It's like, who actually cares? It doesn't matter. And it doesn't diminish or increase your love for Die Hard in one direction or the other. But it's the one argument I can get my head around, because I feel like we're all just having a good time arguing about it and not, you know, ostracizing one another.
If I may, let me settle an argument here, because I'm sure there's somebody yelling at me. I keep saying a bunch of things wrong in this episode. It's going to keep happening. I'm going to promise you that now. NBC didn't start running it in the 70s. They started running it in the 90s.
Oh,
what I was thinking about in the 70s is when local television stations started to run it. And in the 80s, when it was thought to be public domain, local TV stations would play this a lot, especially at Christmas time when they're trying to fill their schedule, because it was free. It was public domain, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until Republic Pictures enforced its claim to the copyright in 1993 that it squelched that. But it's definitely an example where the value of public domain exceeded the value of copyright protection, right? The value for the revival of interest in It's a Wonderful Life can arguably be made because so many local television stations could play it because it was free to play. And so many people learned about it, and it enriched people's lives because they knew about it. And then when it went back under copyright protection, now only NBC gets to show it.
Right.
But NBC is benefiting from the several decade long public domain spurt, because that's how it got popularized,
right?
With all these local TV stations running it. So it actually was used as an example in the 1998 Copyright Term Extension Act debates, as why the copyright term shouldn't be extended.
It's a fun
look what happened when we thought this was public domain, and and how much benefit the public had, and how much benefit the film itself got for that, you know, versus the limited benefit that a copyright owner would have.
Who knew we were going to have such a cool little microcosm of one of your favorite subjects, which is, you know, public domain versus copyright, copyright law, and how it needs to change or stay or whatever. All this talk you've had for all these years I've known you. And this movie's got some nice little, you know, little points of light in it for your argument. I like it. Nothing wrong with that. Okay. I'm going to say this because I don't want to forget. It's in my notes. Genuinely freaky body of water to jump into, like legit in the snow and the wind and that raucous water down there. And from, and that is something I absolutely remember as a kid, is George Bailey looking into that water off that bridge and me thinking, freaking no way, dude, I am never, ever going to jump into a body of water like that. Not in those conditions, not at night. Like F that to the highest degree of,
not
of F
this that. Way, not no how.
Yeah. And I was just like, no way, no how am I ever doing that? And it's still, I looked at it this time thinking, oh, now I'm going to see the seams and it's going to be an okay effect and it's not going to be that. Uh-uh, dude, that is a nasty ass, don't want to go anywhere near the edge thing. So congratulations, Frank Capra. I think you have the scariest body of water in all films made in the 1940s. I'm convinced of it.
We'll put it up there. Yeah, right?
It's right up there. I just don't like it. I don't like when the kid's in the ice either. That freaks me out. There's something about dark, deep water that's always been a thing for me anyway, so I come to this with a bit of a bias. But, like, for real, freaked me out. Did not like, do not want. None of that's any good. And when he, it's so good, because when he's about to do it and the angel jumps in instead, he's... It's so great at showing the character again, because what it does is it says, all right, well, he's at his last leg. This is it. He's going to go. He's already ruined all his relationships that night. He's just about to end it all. He's done. Uh-oh, someone needs help. Takes off his coat, dives in like a professional diver, and saves the dude. It's such a great way of reminding you that, no, George Bailey, at his core, he may have his problems. He's got his weirdness. He's got his stuff. But at his core, this dude... is all about doing the right thing in the situation that he's in. And so he does the right thing. And that hit me so hard this time. It's not supposed to do that. The movie's old. What am I? Suddenly I'm pliable like Plato? Like, what's going on? They're playing with my emotions. Freaking Frank Capra's laughing wherever he is now. Way to go, Scott. I got you again with my black and white emotions. Recently colorized emotions.
You're possibly colorized by three different people emotions.
Yeah, it's just insane to me that worked so well. Okay, I found the Burton Ernie thing. I'm gonna tell you.
And I found the Seneca Falls thing. Seneca Falls, New York claims that Frank Capra visited their town in 1945 and was inspired to model Bedford Falls after it. Philip Van Dorenstern, the author of the story upon which the movie is based, said in a 1946 interview that the movie takes place in Westchester County.
Oh.
And that he, when he wrote the story, had Califon, New Jersey in mind. And in fact, Califon has a historic iron bridge that sort of fits the pattern of where George Bailey takes his jump. So Seneca Falls has embraced this anyway. They're like, we don't care what Philip Van Dorenstern. They have an It's a Wonderful Life festival every December. They have a Hotel Clarence. named after the angel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So,
sure.
But it was Philip Van Dorenstern who said, no, it's actually a place in New Jersey.
All right, there you go. Own it, I say. Go ahead and just accept that it's you, and who cares what anyone else says. Just say it's from your town. Okay, the Bert and Ernie thing. I found this on the Muppet Wiki, which is a pretty intense wiki. Just to get that out of the way, I was looking at this earlier today. Monstrous wiki about nothing but Muppets. And it's got everything from early Jim Henson stuff all the way up to modern day stuff. And one of the entries is, are Bert and Ernie named after characters from It's a Wonderful Life? So there used to be this website called askhenson.com.
Okay.
Which doesn't exist anymore, but it was a way for you to ask the Henson company and family questions about the history of the stuff, and they would answer a lot. This is very early web. But here's what they came back with. While Bert and Ernie's names have often been linked to those of the cop and the cab driver in It's a Wonderful Life, Jim Henson and others have always said that it was just a coincidence. Apparently, Bert and Ernie's names were picked just because the creators slash writers liked them, they fit the characters, and they sounded good together. I lean toward Tom's point of view, which is, even if they didn't know, this was such an important movie impactfully for their generation, it's entirely possible that without thinking much about it, they went Bert and Ernie, and it sounded good because it happened to sound good in another thing.
And they didn't
loved.
Remember why, yes. Right? I've done that where I picked something, and then later someone's like, oh, did you do that because of this? I'm like, maybe I did.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it at the time, but yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's probably what happened, but they claim there's no for sure on
Although,
this.
Although, again, in the 60s, I'm not sure It's a Wonderful Life was as culturally pervasive as it became later.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe it was.
And then there's one other thing. The show referenced a persistent rumor, or referenced this persistent new rumor, in 1996 during the special Elmo Saves Christmas episode. In one scene, Ernie and Bert walk by a TV set which is playing the movie.
Ah.
The pair are surprised by the following dialogue. Bert, Ernie, what's the matter with you two guys? You were here on my wedding night. This is lines from George. And they act surprised by it and then keep walking. So they've at least acknowledged.
They referenced it.
Yeah. That's fine. That's cute. This is a great wiki, by the way. I would highly recommend this. If you're into puppets and Muppets, it's awesome.
We have found your home if you have not found it
already. Yeah, if you're ever like, oh man, what's the deal with the shrimp-looking puppet Muppet that looks like a shrimp, Pepe the Shrimp or whatever, I want to know more. Oh, you'll know everything you need to know right here on the Muppet Wiki. So anyway, there's a nice little...
Also, you were talking a little bit about, you know, it does get a little bit 1940s, not as much as some of the other things from the 40s, but, you know, when he has no longer been born, mm-hmm. and he goes into Nick's, it's no longer Martini's, it's Nick's, and he doesn't mm-hmm. notice at first, and Nick says, I serve hard drinks for hard drinkers, or whatever he said. It's such a great 40s line.
Oh, yeah. I have it, I think. Hold on. Did I capture that one? I might.
Did you? I hope you did.
Oh, yeah, I did. Here it is right here. This is him. Here you go.
Hey, look, mister. We save hard drinks in here for men who want to get drunk fast, and we don't need any characters around to give the joint atmosphere. Is that clear?
He's just so fair. Same. That's
very... We serve hard drinks. So yeah. Over the top, but I love it.
There's a bunch of those, but yeah, I love that about it.
Maybe you have this one, maybe you don't, but I think the quote... that exemplifies my love for the natural dialogue. The fact that not everything is pristine, not everything is picture perfect, right? Mm. We're getting this amazing romance, but it's a real romance.
Yeah.
George Bailey says, am I talking too much? Right. When mm-hmm. he's, you know, when he's leaning in to kiss Mary, and the guy upstairs looking down on the street, cause in reality, nobody gets any privacy, right? It goes, yes. Why don't you kiss her instead of talking her to death? Which would have been a great moment, right?
Yeah, sure.
But Capra goes for broke and has George Bailey go, how's that? And the guy has to repeat himself. I said, why don't you kiss her instead of talking her to death? Oh, you want me to kiss her, huh? Youth is not wasted on the young. Youth is wasted on the wrong people.
Yeah. Is that where the quote is from, supposedly? The youth is wasted?
No, on youth is wasted on the young, I think, is just an old aphorism. Oh, okay. But
all right.
The youth is wasted on the wrong people is a twist on it.
It's pretty good, yeah. Also, you know, that whole thing with his one deaf ear, it's never answered, but did he get both ears working at the end, like as a little gift, a little parting gift from his heavenly...
Oh, you think he did? That's an interesting theory.
Yeah.
Why? Because he never... Well, I mean,
he's used to
a
life,
position where somebody's talking in the bad ear, is he?
No, and he's used to a life of having a bad ear.
Yeah.
So it's not like if he had to resort back to it after things shifted, that it would be that big of a problem for him. But what's interesting is when he knew who he was again, that he was George Bailey and that everyone recognized him, is when the cop pulled up, Ernie or Bert, whichever one he was. And that's how he knew. He's like, oh, you know, of course I know you or whatever. And that happened. In my head, I was going, well, no, the way you'd know is suddenly you couldn't hear out of that left ear again. Because you'd be going back to the
That's a really good
thing.
Point.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
I wouldn't call it a plot hole. I just kind of want to know.
If Zuzu's pedals go away, right. his ear problem would go away because he never fell in the ice. That's
unless he got a little heaven gift or something, you know, because this is all very set in this idea of, you know.
Well, but he never mentions that he can hear out of his ear, does he? Or does he?
I don't remember. I don't think he does. And so that's why I'm saying, like, they just kind of left that hanging. Now,
is that the plot hole related to the brother?
No, this. So the plot hole there is, he. In fact, it worked for me to say, "Oh, your ear's fine." And in my head, I'm going, "Oh, that's because he never saved his brother, never caught that cold, never had the infection, never lost his hearing." So to me, that worked great. But where it broke was that his brother is shown. They show the gravestone of the brother, and they show the year that he died was the year he died in the pond.
Right.
And so the assumption there is that. I guess you could explain it by saying, well, he was there with other people and drowned because nobody saved him because George didn't exist. I guess that's what they were saying. So maybe it's not a plot
hole.
No, that
is what they were saying.
It's just a little bit weird that I don't think the kid would have... If George isn't going to be there, and now the town's a different name, the bar's a different name, all these things have changed, why would that one scenario stay exactly the same minus him in it? Because he was a big part of it. He was saying, heck, don't be a chicken. I'm not a chicken. George. And
I see what you're saying. Yeah. I see what you're saying. In other words, why he might not have, his brother might not have gone down the hill at all.
Yeah. Yes.
If George wasn't there, because
in theory, although, I mean, it's possible.
Although, okay. Yeah. If I may, this just for kicks, let me make the argument against it.
Yeah.
If we're positing the effect of George Bailey not being there at that point, George Bailey's very young.
Yeah.
And the effect of the young on things is less than when he, like, his big effect is when he stays to keep the building and loan going, when he gives people their hope during the depression. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's when he keeps things out of Potter's hand. So not much would have changed at the point where his brother falls in the lake.
That's a good point.
You could conceivably say, like, oh, most things are still going along the same route because young George didn't have as much effect on the world as that. Although, he doesn't stop the pharmacist from putting poison in the in the pills.
Right.
And then that guy gets busted and becomes a drunk.
Yeah.
Because he's been busted for, you know, poisoning people.
Sure.
We see that. We see that reflected in Nick's. But I don't know. I think George's brother still goes down the hill because George's brother is now the oldest.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
He's
right.
No longer the baby brother who's afraid. He's the bold older brother. How about that?
Right. No, that works. That totally works. It's not a hole so much as it is a, I don't know. It's just a thing they kind of glance over.
I mean, honestly, if you really want to start picking at it, like, George being gone wouldn't have caused everything to be exactly the same, except George isn't there. Right. Like, starting with George, with his brother, but also, like, oh, so no one else would have caught the poison, or, you know, maybe Hitler doesn't even rise to power because a butterfly flapping his wings has effects and it just, you know, changes everything in the world.
Right.
You know, maybe his friend doesn't go start the plastics business either. Like, all kinds of things could change. So you can get really caught up in nitpicking, like, well, why would everything be the same except only the parts that George, you know, why wouldn't have someone else stepped up and helped?
Well, plus these movies all can end up being not dreams, but, like, whenever I watched Christmas Carol, I never take that stuff literally. I assume he's dreaming these things and it's changing his mind. He comes out a different man. But he's not traveling through time. He's not hanging out.
Of course he is.
Well, I mean, he is if you take it literally. And in my case, I just never did.
He got visited by a ghost.
I just never did. I always just took it as, like, oh, he's
sleeping.
Well,
your interpretation, the biggest plot hole in A Christmas Carol for me is that he wakes up and they're like, oh, they did it all in one night after all.
Yeah.
Which I have always explained as Dickens wrote these things in serial form for publications and didn't know what the ending when he started the story and was like, ah, crap, I don't want it to be 3 days later. I want it to be Christmas. Spirits did it all in one night.
Sure.
But yeah, if he's just dreaming them, then it would have all just been a dream in one night.
Well, it smacked me pretty good in the face, this movie, with its message. And I think that the idea the idea that's there is a really good one. This idea that a single life does change things, or things are different without them. No matter who they are, something changes. And I really like that message. So here's what I'm going to propose. And don't get all freaked out, everybody at home who worships this movie as the greatest thing of all time. I'm not asking for a direct remake here, but what I am asking for is a quality shadow remake. This happens sometimes with like Shakespeare stuff.
There's already a bunch of
there, and there is a bunch, but I don't think on any of them are even close to as good as this is. I think this is
so
good.
It happened one Christmas.
Yeah.
With Marlo Thomas.
Yeah. How was that?
Horace Leachman as Clara Oddbody.
Okay.
Orson Welles as Mr. Potter.
Oh, I saw this somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a picture of this.
Then for you Hallmark Channel folks, The Christmas Spirit, starring Nicolette Sheridan as Charlotte Hart.
Yeah.
Made for TV film, aired in 2013.
I think I've seen that one because Kim made me. And
there's also
terrible.
A sequel in 1990 called Clarence, starring Robert Carradine.
What? Shut up.
As,
for real?
As the new tales of the helpful angel.
No. Is that real?
Yeah. That's real.
Oh, that's enough to just, that's after MASH. That's no good. You can't do
Oh,
that.
Speaking of MASH, Wayne Rogers is in It Happened One Christmas.
Oh, yeah, I saw that one. I thought it was MASH at first because he's in like a captain's hat and like his fancy dress stuff he never wore on MASH. But I was like, wait, what is this? Oh, it's another one of these. I mean, there are obviously plenty of these kinds of things. I'm just saying right now, somebody who's really good with this material, I don't know who it is. Give it a slight, give it a different setting, modern it up some, but make it genuinely like really good, not just a knockoff. I think it can be done. I found myself on the mood for it. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, sure. I think the thing about What's a Wonderful Life, like you said, is it's really taking the model of the stories like A Christmas Carol and coming up with a new way of telling it. So yeah, I think there's all kinds of ways to do that. And I think it's telling that all of these remakes that we're talking about are not It's a Wonderful Life. They're It Happened One Christmas. They're The Christmas Spirit. They're takes saying, oh, well, what if George was a woman? Or, you know, what if it's a different situation?
Yeah.
So,
well,
yeah,
I really liked it and I'm really glad it was on our list. And I don't know if it's just the Christmas time that's working for me here or what's happening, but I think it's
Christmas
awesome.
Spirit got you going.
It did get me going. And I don't know, it was really effective and I kind of want to watch it again, weirdly, with my kids again. And I just really like, yeah, Tom Hanks would be great in that role. See, there's some talk in the chat room. That's not bad. Some good stuff.
No, not bad.
Spielberg could make it. He makes good sappy stuff. You know,
I feel like Capra and Spielberg are kindred spirits.
Oh, totally.
Right?
Yeah. Like it feels like Spielberg just carried on the torch, you know, and he's just still got some stuff in him. He could probably do it. Ron Howard, maybe, but whoever. I'm just saying I'm in the mood for it now because this was so well done. I think that speaks to the quality of this movie. So good job, 1947. You got me.
I would tell people, if you haven't seen It's a Wonderful Life in a long time, and the reason you haven't seen it is because you feel like you got tired of it or you're over it, watch it again.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree.
I get if you've watched it every year for the past 10 years and this is the year you're like, you know, I need a break. I get that. You can get burnout on it.
Yeah.
But if it's been a while, like it was for me and Scott, you probably forgot a lot of the great parts of it. And it really does hold up.
I forget so much about it. And I'm so glad I watched it. And I hope you guys watch it as well, especially this time of year, because yes, it is a Christmas movie, even though I think you can watch it outside of Christmas, but still.
Oh, yeah, totally.
It's a good Christmas movie.
It was even released in January.
Yeah, which is really weird. That throws me, because that's how you don't get the big box office. You put it out in the month where no one cares about the holiday that it's in. So anyway, next month, what are we doing? Do we know what we're doing?
We're doing a little 1977, moving closer to the present, a little science fiction flick. From the American Graffiti director, George Lucas, called Star Wars.
Oh, I haven't seen that in 30 years. I've heard of it. I think I know what it is. I'm pretty sure I have an idea. Okay, cool.
I heard it referenced in a Billy Joel song. That's really all I know.
I saw a Christmas special once that I don't think it was very good.
If it's as good as the Christmas special I saw, then it should be great.
I'm all in for this. So Howard the Duck creator... or director, George Lucas and his little film Star Wars.
Or the movie creator.
That'd be great. I actually really look forward to that. What a great way to kick off our movie series for 2019, which is what we'll be in.
Yeah. The only question is, and I think both of us have both versions. Do we watch the currently distributed version with fixes and Jabba the Hutts, or do we watch the original, like, theater release version with no episode 4 in the scroll or any of that?
What's the most accessibly available to us that it,
well, I have a DVD that has the original on it.
I did too.
I thought you had that too.
I did, but I lent it to somebody and they've never given it back.
Oh, no.
I know. Okay. I got to talk to him. Maybe I'll just talk to him and get it before next month. But if not, I feel like we need to do the original cut, like the original theatrical. I feel like
that too, because that's the spirit of this, is watching the movies that as they came out.
Yeah. We got to do it. We got to do that. Yeah. The despecialized version is what Wolverine in the chat calls it. That's about right. So that'll be next month.
Before it was special.
Next week. See, we will have an episode next week because it's not the Christmas Eve is the next week. So there will be an episode next week, and it will be a normal sort of conversational news nerdy thing. So come back.
It'll be
for that.
A wonderful episode.
It will be a wonderful episode with two wonderful lives hosting.
I'll get really upset early on and say, I wish I had never been on this episode. And then Scott will show me what the episode would be like without me.
I'll dive into the episode.
It's actually a pretty good episode.
Yeah,
but
yeah. I'll jump into a vat of burning lava. You'll pull me out. It'll all work out. It'll all be fine. So that's coming up. A reminder, if you like this show and you like what we're doing with this thing, a lot of you already do this, and we really appreciate you doing this. But if you haven't yet, consider supporting us at our Patreon at patreon.com/currentgeek. That's patreon.com/currentgeek. Every little bit helps. And it's an easy way to support creations you love from creators you like. Or you can love us, too. One thing I forgot to mention. George Bailey is way too comfortable kissing his mother on the lips. Okay, that was just the thing I wanted to get out of the way. Just a little
that
side.
That was the time, I guess.
Side note. We must have been well past that time when I was a kid, because, I mean, I'll kiss my mom on the cheek, but lips, man.
But yeah, seriously.
No, thank you. All right. There's that. And what else? Tom, do you have anything else you want to mention before we get out of here?
Yeah. I don't know how many people remember, but I used to do a podcast with Molly Wood. A long time ago, I did one called Buzz Out Loud. Not as long ago, but 5 years ago, I did one called It's a Thing. Well, It's a Thing's coming back.
What?
Me and Molly Wood will be podcasting together again starting Thursday. So if you'd like to subscribe and hear us talk about things, just me and Molly talking about trend spotting things, fun stuff, go subscribe at itsathing.me. Or support us on Patreon, patreon.com/itsathing.
That is a huge piece of news. I had no idea. That's so cool. I'm very excited.
Yeah, we just announced it a few days ago that we're bringing it back.
Oh,
It's
my
a Thing
gosh,
is back.
That's nuts. Coming full circle here. All right. Well, I'm very excited. That's how I first ran into you guys, was that.
I know.
That Buzz Out Loud. So watch for that. That's coming up soon. I have nothing to top that. I don't have anything to top that. What do I have? I know. You know what? There's still... It might be a little tight, but there's still shopping time, I guess, for these Christmas tags I made. If you're making gifts for your friends and you want to send those to people for a very low price at frogpants.com/store, there's these fun little tags that has a picture of Santa scrutinizing his list, and next to him it says, I think this is yours. And then it says, to and from, and you can handwrite them on there and boop, put them on your gifts, and you're good to go. Everybody always has to get those every year. Why not get those? They're hand-drawn by me, and you can get them now, and they're cheap. And I think we're probably getting close to being out of them, so you might want to get on those quick. And yes, to someone asking in the chat and others who may be wondering, the Kickstarter playing card decks that I did way back in the summer are shipping. People are already getting them. I saw some pictures today. Should be getting yours soon if you haven't seen it yet. They're on their way. All right. Well, Tom, I think that's it. Thank you all for watching. Have a fantastic week. Again, we'll squeeze another one in before you guys all have your Christmases. So that'll be fun. But and you know, who knows? Maybe some of the news we scrape next week will have some Christmas bent to it. You never know. You won't know till you get there. So come on back and check that out. Currentgeek.com is the place to go. We got everything there, and you can find what you need. So check it out. Currentgeek.com. Send us your emails. Do all that stuff. Find us on Twitter. That's going to do it for this show. For me, for Tom. We'll see you guys next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week we cover a case in Illinois from November, suggested by subreddit user Gavre, that shows how internet technologies can sometimes force the spotlight on lesser-known laws and methods of trying to enforce intellectual property. The case is titled Allen Ross Machinery v. Machinio Corporation, and the allegedly infringing conduct of Machinio included using web scraping to extract sales listings from Alan Ross's website and then copying those sales listings on their own site. The copied material into the Machinio website was mostly factual and did not include any specific branding of Alan Ross, so traditional enforcement of a copyright or a trademark was not really available. However, Alan Ross generated a couple of lesser-known claims under the copyright and trademark laws to try and defend their rights against this practice of web scraping. The first claim was for violation of the Copyright Act's prohibition against distributing false copyright management information or removing or altering such CMI. CMI is generally defined as identifying information placed on a notice of copyright or on a work, and is most often seen online as visible watermarks on images or copyright information embedded in metadata. The provision came into effect as a part of the DMCA in the late 90s. If a defendant knowingly removes or alters such CMI when distributing the underlying work so as to disguise potential copyright infringement, the defendant can be liable for thousands of dollars of damages under this legal claim, which is separate and independent from a traditional copyright infringement claim. For example, the copyright doesn't even need to be registered with the Copyright Office to sue on the CMI ground, which is the opposite of traditional copyright infringement lawsuits. Alan Ross failed to prove violation of this law according to the court. As to distribution of false CMI, which was alleged to be done by Machinio at a blanket copyright notice found in the terms of use on Machinio's website, the court ruled that the separate terms website is not conveyed with the works on other websites, and thus cannot be false CMI connected to the works. As to the other claim, that Machinio removed the CMI in the form of a copyright notice found at the bottom of Alan Ross's web pages, the court ruled this notice covered Alan Ross's website itself, and not the particular sales listings on the website. So just copying the facts in the form of a sales listing did not allow for a claim of removal of CMI from a copyrighted work. The second claim was for false designation of origin under the Lanham Act, which is the trademark law in the U.S. False designation of origin exists when a manufacturer or seller lies about the country of origin or the maker of its products. This is kind of analogous to CMI removal claims, just in the branding or source identifier context. Unfortunately for Alan Ross, there was a prior Supreme Court case called Daystar, which ruled that these claims attach only to the producer of tangible goods offered for sale, not to authors of any idea or communication or concept embodied in those goods. In this case, the copied elements of sales listings were deemed to be ideas or communications embodied in the websites, as the actual website listings of Machinio were made by the source of those products. In other words, Machinio produced website listings using someone else's content, and these website listings did not falsely designate Alan Ross as the source of the website listings, so there's no breaking of the law, just like the prior Daystar decision. This is a nuanced application of that prior law, but it makes sense. The bottom line is, Alan Ross Machinery tried to come up with some creative ways under the U.S. law to enforce their rights and stop the practice of web scraping done by Machinio on sales listings from Alan Ross's website. But these lesser-known enforcement methods did not work in this case. However, the lesson to be learned is that there's usually some way to try and stop copying of content, even if the traditional methods of IP enforcement do not apply. And good legal counsel can open doors not often known to exist in these fields, especially when dealing with cutting-edge fields like internet commerce with relatively newer practices like web scraping. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.